It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to the Fox River that underwent one of the largest river contamination cleanups anywhere in the world. We explore the restoration backstory and how it connects to environmental cleanups today. Join in throughout this conversation. Call in with questions. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Susan Campbell was an environmental reporter in this era at the Green Bay Press Gazette, who wrote hundreds of stories about the pollution of the river by Green Bay area paper companies, and is co-author of this new book, Paper Valley, The Fight to Clean Up the Fox River. Susan, welcome to the Ideas Network. Hi, Susan, can you hear us? We're having some trouble hearing Susan. Let's go to Dave Allen is here as well, retired wildlife biologist and environmental consultant. And in the 90s, writing the natural resource damage assessment that brought about the eventual $1.3 billion cleanup. Dave, welcome. Can you hear us?
I sure can. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Well, we're going to pick up Susan here in a moment. Susan, are you there? And we're still going to work on Susan's connection. Dave, let's start with you. You were hired in 1992 by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to contribute to a natural resource damage assessment of this PCB problem in the Fox River in the Bay of Green Bay. What was the history and scope of the problem? Can you bring us up to speed on that?
Sure. Back in the 1950s, a company called NCR invented a new kind of paper called carbonless copy paper. And it was made so that you didn't get that carbon on your hand when you were making, you know, receipts and things and forms in triplicate. And the problem was the stuff that they used to transfer the ink between the layers of that paper was PCBs. And PCBs were originally used for things like transformers and things like that, but it turned out they were also good for some other uses like this. And so NCR started making this kind of paper right on the Fox River at the Appleton plant. And part of the process of making that paper caused some leakage of that coating stuff with the PCBs in it to go out their pipes into the river. And then on top of that, there were a bunch of recycling mills on the Fox River that invented ways to clean up that paper for recycling. So they would put the clean fibers into new paper, but the old the stuff that had the PCBs in it would go right out of their pipes right into the river. So both the manufacturer and the recycling of the PCBs caused the Fox River to get chock full of PCBs in the sediments. By the 70s, the EPA and DNR had required that they stop having any of those discharges from their pipes. But by then, there was all this PCB already in the sediment. So by the 90s, when I got hired by Fish and Wildlife Service, the issue was, what are we going to do about these PCBs that keep coming from the sediments of the Fox River and getting distributed throughout the Bay of Green Bay and into Lake Michigan, where it was causing all kinds of problems? And we were trying to figure out if we could use Superfund or some sort of a voluntary process to try to figure it out. And my agency wanted to use the Superfund process. And so that's where it all started.
And, you know, just explain how lethal PCBs are, how they spread throughout wildlife, and the impact on the environment with this toxic chemical.
Right. So the first thing about PCBs is they're toxic at really, really low levels. So if you have one part of PCBs in 10 trillion parts of water, you've already reached the standards, the water quality standards, to protect human health, aquatic life, and wildlife. So you don't need very much of this PCB to cause a problem. The kinds of problems include, you know, cancer, reproductive effects, hormonal effects. You can get deformities. All sorts of things happen once they get out there. Then on top of that, PCBs were specifically invented so that they would not break down even with high heat and electricity, because they were originally used for transformers. But that also means they don't break down in the environment. So once they get out there, they stick around for decades and decades, probably even centuries. And then the last thing about them is, because the same thing that makes them good for transferring ink in a paper, they like to bind to organic material and they don't like to bind to water. means that they accumulate into organisms. They bioaccumulate every level up the chain, so you get higher and higher concentrations as you get larger and larger organisms. And so they stick around, they bioaccumulate, and it doesn't take very much to cause all of these different kinds of problems.
And those problems just proliferate in the environment. Talking about the pollution and cleanup of PCBs in the Green Bay area with Dave Allen, co-author of the new book, Paper Valley, The Fight for the Fox River Cleanup. You can join in with questions and comments about this work, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dave, throughout your time with Fish and Wildlife in Green Bay, you took these meticulous notes, and you know, you had your notebooks and so many documents about this pollution. Can you explain just why that you couldn't get everyone on board, you know, seeking to bring the court case against the paper mills, the polluters?
Sure. So The first thing I'll say is the reason I took all those notes is we figured when we started this case, we figured that it was probably going to cost at least hundreds of millions of dollars to fix this problem. Mm-hmm. It turned out to cost $1.3 billion. So we were right. It was, you know, it was going to be expensive. And we knew that if we were going to try to get the private sector, the paper companies, those who are responsible for the PCBs, to pay that much money, we were going to have the help of the courts. The courts were going to have to basically say to the paper companies, you actually have to do this, because they weren't going to voluntarily spend that much money on it. And because it was going to go to court, I knew that right at the very beginning that this was going to be a big Superfund case. So I figured that if it ever went to a trial, I would get called as a fact witness because I was right in the middle of the case. And I knew it was going to be very controversial. So I took notes on everything, every meeting, every person, you know, every detail, and kept meticulous records, assuming that I would someday end up in court. Then to the other part of your question, you know, why was it hard to get everybody to go along? Well, a lot of times at Superfund sites, especially if they're not so expensive, if they're only like, you know, $1 million or a few hundred thousand dollars or maybe even $10 million, it's cheap enough that nobody, it's not worth going to court for either side. The court would probably cost, you know, $1 million or $10 million. So you don't want to spend $1 million or $10 million on court if you can fix the site for $100,000 or $1 million. But if once the expense gets high enough, that calculus changes, right? So I think a lot of people at the beginning thought, well, maybe we can get this thing fixed for a few million dollars or a few tens of millions of dollars, and maybe we can do it voluntarily. And I think that difference of opinion about how big the site was really going to be caused some groups and some factions within each group to think, let's do this voluntarily and keep the lawyers out of it. But those of us on the side that thought it was going to be $100 million or $1 billion said, that's just unrealistic. And so we had this very long struggle between factions that thought, let's keep it uncontroversial, not legalistic, and those that said, there's no way to avoid that. And that set up about a 10-year argument, mostly between the state of Wisconsin, who wanted to do it voluntarily, and then Michigan, the feds, and the tribes, who thought this is going to be such a big deal, we'll have to go to court.
At one point, you say that high-stakes Superfund litigation was more like a full contact sport. And there's also the stigma that goes along with saying a place is a Superfund site. What impact do you see there?
Yeah, so, you know, it is like a full contact sport. I mean, you know, if you put $1 billion at stake, if you go to a private company or a set of private companies and say, we want to spend $1 billion of your dollars on something that has nothing to do with your business, that means it's going to be a heated argument. That means you're going to have to actually win cases in court. And so, you know, it is not an easy thing to do. And honestly, the reason I wanted to write this book was I want people to remember that in order to succeed at these very expensive sites, you basically have to go through that controversy and that difficulty to prove your case, even to skeptical people on the other side. And so, you know, I think that's how it turned out. I mean, it ended up, you know, a 10-year administrative struggle between agencies and then another 10 or 15 years of litigation, which the government's won. But you got to do that. And then as to the stigma, it is true that people don't want to be called a Superfund site. So there is a stigma with the label. But it's not really the label which causes the stigma, right? It's the pollution. So you can call it a Superfund site or not, but you still have one of the biggest PCB contamination problems in the country, and that's the real stigma. You've got to do something about that, or you have to live with that stigma.
Paper Valley co-author Dave Allen, retired U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist and environmental consultant. Join the conversation at any point on Fox River pollution and restoration. Call in with the question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The authors call it one of the largest, most divisive, and politically charged environmental river cleanups. The over $1 billion fix for widespread chemical contamination of the Fox River. Join in along the way. Call in with questions, comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. The book is called Paper Valley, and co-authors Dave Allen and Susan Campbell are here. Susan, in 1993, you and your husband move from Philadelphia to Green Bay to work for the Press Gazette. How did the PCB pollution of the Fox River become a priority subject of your reporting?
Hi, good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
So when we moved to Green Bay, I didn't start out immediately as the environmental reporter because the environmental beat was fallow. They hadn't been covering it for a couple of years anyway. But they decided they saw Dave and his team gathering steam with the natural resource damage assessment, and there'd been a focus group also the summer before that had said they would very much like to see an environmental beat at the Press Gazette, and so. In 1996, the paper invited me to cover the environment, and I was thrilled to do it. And right away, Fox River cleanup became the main focus of my beat. So it was well timed, and definitely the paper had that as their intention, that they wanted to cover that story aggressively.
And your first impressions, I mean, you wrote about how you meet Dave and you thought that U.S. Fish and Wildlife officials might not be a match for the, you know, suit and tie, well-heeled executives at the paper mills. What were those first impressions in responding to this crisis?
Right. My very first meeting, and it had been talked up by the former environmental reporter at the Press Gazette. Had told me, you're going to meet the U.S. Fish and Wildlife official Dave Allen, who's at the crux of this effort. And I was a little intimidated, thinking this is going to be, you know, pretty intimidating guy. And I drove up to the Fish and Wildlife Service building, and I talk about it in the book that it's just the most nondescript building. It looks like an old decrepit post office on the outskirts of town, and I was greeted and ushered inside, and then I met David Allen and one of his colleagues, Ken Stromberg, and I was expecting, you know, I'd been covering courts out in suburban Philly, so I was well versed with covering courts and lawyers, and Dave Allen, it might describe him as he seemed like a Boy Scout. I thought an Eagle Scout.
Dave, you can speak up and defend yourself at any point here.
No, I agree with Susan, and I think it's my favorite passage in the whole book. It's hilarious.
I mean, yeah. Dave, did you feel like a Dave versus Goliath type story going on here, going up against these paper mills and their ally, the DNR?
Well, you know, it's funny. You know, I came from US EPA in Chicago, and so I had a regulatory background already, and I was used to dealing with high-powered executives in companies already. And it is true that I was just a simple field biologist with big round glasses, and I was young and did not look intimidating. But I think that actually worked to my advantage. I think people underestimated not just me, but our whole team. You know, we had a team that was hundreds of people over the whole country, but I was sort of the face of it. And so I was ready for the suit and tie executives, but I don't think I looked the part very much. And it took a while. And honestly, I think that's part of the reason why it took a while for DNR to take us seriously, because they probably figured we weren't really for real the first couple of years.
Let's go further on that. You write that the DNR secretary at the time, George Meyer, opposed the involvement of Oneida Nation tribal authorities in the damage assessment process, was in talks with the paper companies. How would you characterize this reaction from the DNR regarding the prospect of cleaning up the Fox River and the Bay of Green Bay?
Yeah, so, you know, I've thought about that a lot, and I think the guys at DNR, especially in the leadership, were in a terribly difficult position, because it was absolutely 100% clear that the governor did not want Superfund, did not want the federal government, and did not want the tribes involved. So that was crystal clear, right? I think the DNR as an institution very much wanted to do this cleanup and wanted to find the best levers to do it, but I think that they thought that they could handle it on their own. And I think that there was, I mean, I don't want to be unnecessarily harsh, but I think there was a little bit of naivete and a little bit of arrogance in that attitude. I think that they thought it would be easy to handle the feds, the tribes, the paper companies, the public, the lawyers, everybody. And, you know, it's a really good agency, very powerful, very storied agency. And so I think they were used to sort of, you know, getting their way. But they weren't used to $1.3 billion Superfund projects. And so they took some positions early on, as you say. They basically said tribes aren't allowed to do this. They even said the federal government wasn't allowed to do this unless they gave permission. And so this was such an extreme position to take that it actually had the opposite effect. Instead of keeping us at bay, it basically united all of the federal lawyers and managers across the entire government to say, well, we simply can't go along with a position that you can't do a federal or a tribal project in a state without the state's permission. That would violate, you know, constitution and, you know, statutes and regulations and all sorts of things. And so they actually managed to catapult the case into the national limelight by taking those extreme positions.
Dave Allen and Susan Campbell, they're co-authors of Paper Valley, The Fight for the Fox River Cleanup. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Susan, David set up these reading rooms, which I was just fascinated by. They were like government filing cabinets containing thousands of pages of documents related to the PCB contamination. What effect did this have on your reporting, on transparency, and what we can learn today?
The reading room was really quite a feat, and personally, I was fortunate in that I was getting documents sent to me via email, and I was able to download them from the internet because the government was starting to put things on the internet. But the reading room itself was just a marvel, and to have Dave describe it in the book is they were just deluged when they were asking the paper companies for information about the PCBs and the river. They were deluged with information and received box after box after box, and the papers were all kind of in a mishmash and mixed up within the boxes, and Fish and Wildlife, Dave and one of his colleagues there sorted through all of these boxes, hundreds of thousands of documents, and put them in file cabinets and date stamped each one, and had cross-referenced directories that would point you to every single document. And it became a stop for not only the public, but also Dave describes how paper company lawyers.
The paper mills was using the reading room, Dave, along with the public. I just found that really amazing. You know, what did you think about as you put that room together?
Well, so I think there are two critically important aspects of that reading room that I hope people understand, and again, hope people will learn from this and do similar things in the future.
And very quickly here before we go to break. Go ahead.
Okay, good. Number one is it levels the playing field for the public, so they have access to the same information as the more sophisticated defendants, the paper companies. And second, it causes the paper companies to mine that information to turn on each other for the allocation part. So we knew that they would use the reading room to turn on each other, and that's in fact what happened.
Co-authors of Paper Valley, Dave Allen, retired wildlife biologist and journalist Susan Campbell, join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The cleanup of the Fox River, ridding it of toxic PCB pollution, that took years of intergovernmental negotiations, followed by a 17-year cleanup that cost over $1 billion. According to federal regulators, Wisconsin certified completion of the cleanup in early 2023. The book is called Paper Valley. Share your thoughts. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234. Co-authors Dave Allen and Susan Campbell are here. Let's bring on a call, Leah in Milwaukee. Hi, Leah.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I grew up in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, along the banks of the Fox River. My sisters and I caught crayfish in the Fox River. We played in the Fox River as kids. I'm just wondering, what are the longitudinal health impacts of this environmental injustice? You know, my mom is a cancer survivor. My sister suffered from infertility. I wonder if there are related longitudinal health impacts for people who grew up in the 80s and played in the Fox River like I did.
Such an important question. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, so I would say, first of all, swimming is probably not a problem in terms of the PCBs. Now, there may have been other things in the river at the same time that could have been a factor. But for PCBs, you're unlikely to get any major exposure by swimming. The bigger problem is eating the crayfish or fish or anything else from the river. So that's the main route that PCBs get into people is from fishing or waterfowl hunting or, you know, eating crayfish and things like that. There have been some longitudinal studies done, I think, out of Wayne State, looking at various effects in people over several decades, and they did see some correlations of, like, IQ and, you know, brain size and things like that in infants and then later on in life. So, you know, whether that's a strict causation is a little bit hard to tell. That's always the problem with human longitudinal studies. But the main thing I would say is this. There's no amount of PCBs that's good for you, and there's always a risk if you ingest them. So, you know, I myself have fished the Fox River and Green Bay my whole life, and I have eaten some of the fish, and so I worry about that as well. But it's a very difficult thing to pin down exactly how much harm comes to people from ingesting different amounts of PCBs.
Susan, Green Bay Press Gazette, your newspaper, ran editorials suggesting that a costly cleanup would result in area paper mills closing, a lot of people out of work. How worried were people in Green Bay at the time about what was happening?
Quite worried, and up and down the Fox River Valley as well. There were obviously a lot of jobs tied to the paper industry in the Fox Valley and Green Bay, and there had been quite a campaign by paper companies saying that if they were forced to do a cleanup, and especially when that dollar figure started reaching up to $1 billion plus, that the jobs would be lost and paper mills would shutter. And that had been a concern. The paper, obviously, we had Fort Howard in our backyard, and there was concern for paper company jobs and the industry, but also, you know, Green Bay itself was located in the final stretches of the Fox River where it emptied into the bay. And this is where the vast majority, 86% of the PCBs had landed. And mm-hmm. so it was in their backyard. It was in the newspaper's backyard. So they felt a real obligation to talk about the human health impacts of it as well. So
let's bring in Kenneth in Beloit with a question. Kenneth, hi.
How are the PCPs disposed of?
Where did they go, you know, once this was, the dredging was complete? Kenneth, thank you. Dave, go ahead.
Yeah, so the PCBs that were dredged out of the river were taken to a special plant that was built for the cleanup right on site, where they dewatered the sediment with big giant presses. They would basically press all the water out of the sediment, and then they would separate out all the sand from the organic material, because the PCBs don't like to stick to sand just like they don't like to stick to water. And that left this very concentrated organic sediment with most of the PCBs in it. And that's what got put into the landfills. And that was put into specially engineered, specially designed landfills near the Fox River. And the responsible parties have continuing responsibility to not only keep those landfills up to spec, but to monitor them closely. So there is some concern always, of course, with, you know, you didn't destroy the PCB, so they are still around the landfills, but it's the smallest volume possible, and it's in the safest possible landfills that can be constructed. So I think we've probably done about as much as we could have done, short of incinerating the sediments, which would have probably made the cost, I don't know, 10 or 20 times higher. So, you know, 10 or 20 billion instead of one.
Chris from Wabino called in and has worked on phosphorus cleanup and thought this was a success story with the amount of PCBs removed. Dave, you know, the paper companies had argued that dredging could stir up and spread the PCBs. How risky is dredging as a form of environmental cleanup?
There are types of dredging that would be risky. So I think the most common kind of dredging that people are used to seeing is navigational dredging. So, you know, digging up the sediment so ships can still go in.
Mm-hmm.
And they usually use great big shovels and just put them on barges. And that would be dangerous, but that's not what the agencies did here. The agencies here use precision hydraulic dredging. So you have an auger, which goes right down to the contaminated spot. You have suction so that the water is going straight into the pipe. We actually have video of the sediment going right into the pipe, and none of it escapes that pipe. And so the type of dredging they used here is extremely safe and was proven to be so through some projects on the Fox River. And then furthermore, they did in some places where the PCBs weren't so high, they used specially engineered caps to prevent anything that was left behind from getting into the fish after the fact.
We're talking about the pollution and cleanup of PCBs in the Green Bay area. Dave Allen and Susan Campbell, co-authors of the new book, Paper Valley. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Jane in Suamico is here. Jane, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, 17 years and $1 billion is huge. And I'm wondering, now that we are aware of the PFAS chemical poisoning, the forever chemical poisoning that's found in 70 different locations and is going into the Bay of Green Bay as well as the Great Lakes, which hold 90% of the fresh water of the United States. I'm wondering, now this is a problem because it's water soluble, where the PCBs are not. Are there any lessons learned that could be translated to the PFAS problem?
Jane, thank you. Dave?
Yes, I think PFAS has got a lot of parallels. There are some differences, of course, as you say, you know, the amount it dissolves in water is one of them. Another one is that they're so ubiquitous. They're everywhere. It's like everywhere you monitor, you find it. And so it's a lot harder to figure out how to fix it. So I would say the biggest lesson from the Fox River PCB cleanup is we have to make sure that the industries that are responsible for the PFAS carry as much of the burden as practical, that we don't want this to just be shifted to the public. And that's what we did at Fox River. I think the same thing can happen to at least some degree on the PFAS issue. Now, again, fixing the PFAS problem, I think, it's a harder thing to do than PCBs, but we clearly have to do something.
Jane, thank you so much for the call. Bob now in Fitchburg. Bob, what's on your mind?
Hi. Yes, I had lived up in the Green Bay area, and I'm an avid fisherman. And I recall, you know, the consumption warnings and such. So we Never really kept any of the fish that we caught and ate any of them. And I'm wondering, now that the cleanup is complete, if they have an idea of how long it would take to cycle through the fish that are in the system right now until we get to a point where they're not contaminated anymore and we could go back to consuming them.
Thank you, Bob. Dave, do you want to field that as well?
Yeah. So right now, the most of the fish are declining in PCBs at a rapid rate, at a quickened rate because of the cleanup. There are still advisories in place on the Fox River, and they're dropping. So I think that, like, so let's say one of the really popular species, walleye. I think for walleye, in one section of the river, you can eat no more than once a month, and in another section, no more than once a week. And what we're hoping for is that soon those will reach, no restrictions at all. And there's a huge monitoring program that's being paid for by the paper companies through the Superfund project to monitor sediments, water, and fish. And so we'll be able to tell when that point is reached. And I think the hope is that we're getting close to unlimited advisories, at least for some species like walleye.
I wonder, Susan, these advisories at the time weren't making it to all people who needed to know and who were fishing the Fox River. What did you find there about communication?
There were a couple of things going on, and one of them was that, yes, the state was and continues to publish fish advisories warning what fish are safe to eat and what shouldn't be eaten and how they should be prepared. But there was a group of subsistence fishermen that were of particular concern, and that was members of the Hmong community. And the concern there was they were ignoring the fish advisories, not because they were scofflaws, but because they couldn't understand the idea of an invisible contaminant that would be contaminating the fish. There was no word in their native Laotian tongue that would describe something like an invisible contaminant. And so they would look at the water and they would say, the water is clean, it's not dirty. And they just didn't believe that this was a hazard to them. And so they would fish daily and bring home fish to their families. And there was another concern too, that contaminants like PCBs are much more of a concern or a heavier body burden on children and developing children in the womb. So the importance of fish advisories and keeping PCBs out of pregnant women and children is especially important. And what the concern was that the vast majority of fishing licenses are purchased by men, and they're the ones, when you receive the fishing license, that's when you would receive the fish advisory. Mm. And so there was a concern that a lot of these fish advisories that were being purchased that were being accompanied with the fishing license were not making it home to the women who were cooking the fish. And then there was one other thing going on where there just weren't enough fish advisories published to keep up with the number of fishing licenses. So there was just not enough of those going around and being
multiple communication issues there. Co-authors of Paper Valley, environmental journalist Susan Campbell and retired wildlife biologist Dave Allen, giving us a lens into the 90s in Green Bay and two decades of cleanup orders and negotiations with paper companies and the intergovernmental negotiations that went on at the same time. Still time to bring up your question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Once one of the nation's largest Superfund cleanup projects, we learn about the massive $1.3 billion removal of PCBs in the Fox River and the inside story of Wisconsin ultimately joining the federal government in the effort, forcing seven paper companies to foot the entire bill for restoration. The book is called Paper Valley. We have co-authors Dave Allen and Susan Campbell. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Paul in Green Bay. Paul, what would you like to share?
Hi, I'd like to say that there are several heroes in this process. And at the top of the list is the Fish and Wildlife Service. The fights between the DNR, Fish and Wildlife Service, the paper mills was huge. I was district director for Congressman Jay Johnson, who was only congressman for 2 years in that time period. Congressman Johnson is no longer with us. May he rest in peace. But I will tell you, Congressman Johnson belongs also at the top of that list. I was at probably every meeting that the congressman had with paper mills who were pressing him to, you know, press the Fish and Wildlife Service and anyone involved in this to lay off, and he would have none of it.
Mm.
We toured the Fox River. We hosted Fish and Wildlife Service. He is deserving of a tremendous amount of credit, because I also know that he lost his race, there was a fair amount of pressure to back off, even though a lot of progress had been made. And I believe to this day that so much progress was made by Fish and Wildlife Service and others that it was too late to turn back after the congressman was defeated.
Paul, thank you for bringing this historical look here. Dave, how did Wisconsin's congressional delegation get involved during these years, decades?
Yeah, so that's another example of being in a difficult position, I think. And I certainly remember Congressman Johnson very well. I remember meeting with him. He was a great supporter. And I remember meeting with the staffers of both Senators Feingold and Cole and others. And they, the difficulty for them was the Fox River Valley is a political stronghold, a very powerful area politically for the entire state. So all the elected officials had to pay attention to what the paper mills were saying. At the same time, you know, they represent the public and they had to listen to the public agencies as well. And I think that at the end of the day, most of the elected officials tried a little bit of intervention, not as much as Governor Thompson, but a little bit. But I think that they very quickly realized that there was enough momentum and enough factual information from, you know, decades of scientific research by people at UWGB and other places that it wasn't practical to stop it. And so I think the elected officials let the agency sort of go forward once Governor Thompson left the state.
Case in point, I think, Susan, from the public's perspective, you write about public comments poured in on Superfund. Over 7,000 residents sent in, you know, during that public comment period about the Fox River. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it was a very divisive issue up and down the river. But there over time, the more information that came out and the more stories that were written about the dangers of PCBs and not only the fish and wildlife, but the people, the more and more people came on the side of wanting this cleanup and actually wanting the river to be designated a Superfund cleanup site, because they felt that it was the only answer to actually getting the river cleaned up. And it, interestingly, you mentioned the public comments. EPA, when they announced that they were going to propose lifting the river for Superfund, they had a 60-day public comment period, and it was really for technical comments. But so many people saw it as a chance to finally be able to weigh in and express their personal opinions that they ended up getting 7,000 comments on postcards. And the majority of them were in favor of the cleanup, although there was certainly a fair representation of people who were against it. But I remember Jim Hahnenberg with EPA saying, you know, these comments are, it was the most, the highest number of comments that EPA had ever received on any proposed Superfund site.
Let's bring in Paul in Delafield now. Paul, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Paul. Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Yeah, my question is, we know that there'll be new chemicals developed all the time. What have we done to anticipate and prepare for the fact that companies will be responsible for the safety, and so we don't get into a situation like this again in the future.
Such a great question, Paul. Thank you, Dave. Go ahead.
The most important aspect of a Superfund site like Fox River is that it proves that the governments can represent the people fairly and win in court. And what this does is it puts everyone on notice in the whole country that if they pollute, they'll be held responsible, or that they can be. And that causes a change in behavior not only for the industries, but for all the real estate agents, all the lawyers, all of the insurance agents. This liability from Superfund, its real power is in teaching that you can be held responsible for the mess you make. And that causes people to try to avoid the mess in the first place. That's the most important thing that we did at Fox River, was to teach the country to pay attention.
Meanwhile, there's the news, Susan. U.S. News and World Report just named Green Bay the best place to live in America. How do you feel about that recognition?
I think it's wonderful. And, you know, I've been up and I've visited. In fact, Dave and I were both up there recently to launch the book. And it's a beautiful transformation that's occurred there. They've spent a lot of money building the city deck there that lines the river, and they've got condos and apartments and restaurants and all this river facing activity and development. And it's really wonderful to see. It's still an industrial working river, but they have made so many strides. So I was really pleased to see that it's getting that recognition. I always thought just the geographic location of it, right there at the mouth of Green Bay, it's really a wonderful place, and I'm glad they're able to maximize that and capitalize on that.
Dave, we have just a few seconds left on your thoughts of this treasure as you, see the Green Bay going forward here.
Well, a great applause for the city of Green Bay, but even closer to my heart is the Bay of Green Bay. I think that we have saved the Bay of Green Bay. It's a jewel of the Great Lakes. It's one of the most beautiful and economically vibrant places in the country. And it's no longer being assailed by PCBs from the Fox River. And so I'm pleased both for the city, but even more for the Bay.
The book is called Paper Valley, The Fight for the Fox River Cleanup. Dave and Susan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dave Allen, retired wildlife biologist, spent 9 years with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, during which he wrote the Natural Resource Damage Assessment regarding harmful PCBs. And Susan Campbell, former environmental reporter for the Green Bay Press Gazette and communications manager for the Alliance for the Great Lakes, and now a Milwaukee area real estate agent, Dave, a musician in Marquette, Michigan. And I just want to express some heartfelt thanks to Maria Lopez on her last day here. You know, she brings a show to life and through the control room. Thank you so much. And all the best on WBEZ. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Natural Resources Defense Council, it describes biophilia as the innate human instinct to connect with nature and other living beings. As we spend about 90% of our life indoors, we learn how to incorporate nature into our spaces. Call in with questions and comments about biophilic design, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie Ryan Balagtas is an environmental design consultant focused on biophilic design, is project director at the New York design firm Terrapin Bright Green. Katie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with what sets biophilic design apart. How is it different from other types of design, say environmental design?
Well, it's actually often mistaken as a type of design, but really it's more of a mindset or a source of inspiration and knowledge. So environmental design is traditionally thought of as like the condition of the soil or, you know, other characteristics that are required to be measured in order to get a building permit, or maybe the condition of the river. But when you talk about biophilic design, it's really about connecting to that land rather than critiquing the biological condition of it and trying to fix that. So from a design standpoint, if you think about architecture or product design or even fabric design or some other aspect of our built environment, even the planning of cities, it's more about what we can learn from nature and the experiences we have within nature and how they influence our design decisions to create healthy, comfortable spaces that we protect and that we love over time.
I wonder then how it connects with like green building, you know, and LEED certification and things like that, whereas, you know, we're really trying to think about climate change and the climate environment around mm-hmm. us as we make those building choices?
It's a great question. I think biophilic design in recent years has kind of been where, say, green building was about 20 years ago, where it was, you know, it sounded kind of nice, but, you know, who's going to pay for it? And it is there, you know, evidence that it really is going to work? So over the last few years, we've been getting over that hump with biophilic design. And so I would say that it supports or is kind of in parallel with the whole green building movement. But the green building movement is largely, or at least traditionally, has been focused on the performance of the building to benefit cost and environmental conditions. So not doing harm to water, or improving the air quality, or reducing the energy bill. But biophilic design is really about the experience of the place. So it's more about the people, how we are designing those very green buildings or not so green buildings to support health and well-being in the space, whether it's in the building or on the street looking at the building. So it's much more about the people in relation to nature.
How does the space in homes or at work affect a person's mood? What is that connection like?
Well, there's a huge range of impacts. They're primarily discussed in terms of physiological health, cognitive performance, and maybe our psychological or mental well-being, including mood or emotion. But more specifically, it could be anything from stress reduction, like including our systolic blood pressure or cortisol levels, which can have, you know, this domino effect on other health conditions. But it also can affect our, you know, our vision, our visual acuity, like how well we see what's in front of us, our sleeping patterns, attention, creativity, even decision-making and problem-solving. It just really depends on how you look at biophilic design. And then I'd say like there's also our perception of calm and comfort and safety, or even perceptions of time and place. And then finally, I'd say that another big area of health impact would be prosocial behaviors, like our perception of self in the grand scheme of things, generosity, humility. So you can see that there's this huge range of potential impacts. And so with biophilic design, it's looking at the science and understanding what are your design priorities, like what are the experience or the health outcomes that you want for the people you're designing for, and then choosing based on the science and nature, like what makes the most sense for what you're trying, the experience you're trying to create.
Almost feels like a holistic approach, almost a way of life, if you will.
Well, yeah, I mean, I try to think of it holistically, when, especially when you're talking about green building, because there's a lot of choices that we make in green building that have already been like financially justified or is a priority for the client whether the client is a building owner or the government, in that, you know, a lot of those decisions about like keeping the electricity bill low, so having good daylight, well, that's both an energy decision, but it's also a health and well-being decision. So how do we think more holistically about design to support both the bottom line and our health and well-being?
Katie Ryan Balogtas, environmental design consultant specializing in biophilic design. You can join in with your questions and comments about designing interior spaces that affect mood and many other things. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Katie, are there some tips or pointers? How can someone design a space with this mindset, with this holistic nature in mind? Like, you know, what is that approach to design like?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple different angles. So if you're starting from scratch, you have perhaps more opportunity. And then the earlier you think about it, the better chance you are to be able to integrate your ideas in. Mm. But if you're just talking about how to make an existing space a little better, you know, it can start off a little bit more biophilic, I should say. You can be looking at your lighting fixture, making it more like an organic design or something that reflects light on the walls in a fun or fractal way, to your choice of upholstery. If there's a pattern, either like something very literal, like the leaf patterns, or maybe it's more abstract, but it has a less geometrical, like forced design, and something that's a little bit more reflective of something that happens in nature. So, you know, patterns, selection of material, like wood surfaces or even a wood structure of a building that is exposed. So you see the wood, you see the grain. So it's really about what you see and touch, the multisensory experience. And then if you're talking about how you orient a building or orient your landscape design, your garden, it's like, what can you see? How do you see through the space? How does the air flow through the space? Is it natural and kind of staggered and not something that you can anticipate? So there's some variability to it.
Well, things like classrooms or hospital hallways, some cubicles that, you know, lack windows. How can you use these visual cues in spaces like that when they lack windows?
That's a great question, because a lot of those spaces used to have windows before the advent of electricity and air conditioning. But we did away with it either for cost, or just, you know, didn't seem necessary at the time. But there's also some misperception of what that experience actually entails. Like windows in schools were often eliminated, if not for cost, then because they were considered a distraction to students. But that has been since proven to not necessarily be true. Depends on what's going on outside. But often kids, research shows that kids that see a view to nature outside are actually going to be more relaxed and focused and do better on their testing and be able to retain more, have better memory than kids who don't have a window or who don't have, or have like too much stuff on the wall that's a distraction from the window. So there are some spaces that are easier to, you know, adapt. Like putting a new window in a public school is going to be tricky. So in that case, creating alternative spaces for, say, kids or whomever to spend in or connected to nature will be perhaps the most cost-effective and health-impactful way to address that disconnection from nature. So having schoolyards that are very vegetated, or encourage getting your hands dirty and learning in nature and playing in nature. Cognitive development is going to be much stronger for those young kids with that experience than in a more, you know, restricted schoolyard.
Katie Ryan Balogtas, environmental design consultant specializing in biophilic design. Call with your questions and comments about nature-inspired interior design, what it means to you, what it does for you. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how biophilic design invites natural elements into architecture. Of course, Anata, Wisconsin's native son, architect Frank Lloyd Wright, who believed nature was an inspirational force. Colin with questions about bringing natural lights and plants and water into living space. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie Ryan Balogtas is an environmental design consultant with expertise in biophilic design. Stays with us. Katie, what about Frank Lloyd Wright? You know, how influential is Wright's design in the biophilic movement?
Actually, I don't think a lot of people talk about him as inspiration, but those people who are well-versed in biophilia or just have been involved in the conversation recognize his work as really foundational to how we think about nature in or nature of the space, which is, you know, really those physical or spatial considerations on how the building works. And then, of course, a lot of his places are have wonderful landscapes and views. So there are multi dimensions to how he has influenced how we think about building and home design. And would you like, let me see some examples I can point
like
to.
Falling water in Pennsylvania, you know, built partly over a waterfall, I would imagine.
Yes.
is an example.
That is an example, and it's probably one of, like, it's just a very obvious one.
Yes, yes.
But that's also, you know, you have the benefit of a wonderful landscape to begin with.
Right.
But some of his designs, some of his buildings and interiors aren't necessarily dependent upon being in this fantastic natural environment. And so, and not everyone has the benefit of that at their disposal, right? Mm. So, he has other examples that I think are really reflective of the period in which he's working in. Like some of his buildings directly affect his mood, his professional or personal state of being at the time, you know, whether his professional state is like he's at the top of his game or if personal things have happened with his family. Like you can see that reflected in some of his buildings, whether there's a lot of refuge, like small dark spaces, versus very open and lots of views, or even risk elements like bird walks out above, you know, above a ravine or a river. So those are spatial characteristics that are very critical to that connection with nature. And they, one of the reasons that we like things like risk and that the mystery of experiencing those spaces is that it releases dopamine. And so there's that pleasure response we get from things like risk. So standing over the waterfall is very exciting for us.
Hmm.
But he also he's designed very different spaces, like the Johnson Wax Administrative Building in Racine.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of my favorites to talk about from a biophilic design perspective. And you wouldn't necessarily, like at first look at it, it doesn't seem biophilic because it has no plants in it, like so, and there's no views, there's no windows. So why is it biophilic? There's three main reasons that I like to refer to this project. Is that the most obvious, I suppose, would be that on the interior you have these really tall tree-like columns sprinkled throughout the work area, and so and then there's this light that kind of electric light above the trees. So it kind of is like you're in a forest with the light shining through.
Hmm.
The other reason is that when you're entering the building from the parking area, the ceilings are really low. It's a very like compressed space. And so that feeling of compression brings you through to the center of the building where it opens up and suddenly the ceilings get really high and there's this sense of release from the space. So that compression release, you're getting the prospect and refuge, but you're also inducing a sense of awe. Like, have you ever walked into a cathedral or gone to the edge of the Grand Canyon or at the top of a waterfall? Like, you get this sense of like amazement, and maybe you pause, your jaw drops, your eyes open, and you're kind of in this different state of being.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So So those are two main reasons, like biophilic qualities to that space, to the Johnson Wax building. But another really key point here is that that building has not been remodeled since it was originally built.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of another office building that has not undergone major renovation in 70 years. Like, it's just, it's almost unheard of. And so there's this point that, like, designing biophilic spaces, spaces that are truly embracing the concepts of nature, spatially or otherwise, are places that people love and they want to take care of. And so they last a lifetime or longer. And that's not pretty typical practice in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Like, we tend to build for the short term, and it's all about return on investment and that initial investment cost. And it's not really thinking about that love
generations.
Of play.
Yes.
And that the fact that health and well-being, like designing for health and well-being, is a long-term investment. So mm-hmm. it's really hard to quantify when you're doing that initial cost, when you're purchasing the concrete and you're, you know, outfitting it with this furniture, that furniture, you're thinking short, you're thinking 10 years maybe. In some cases you might be thinking a little longer, but it's not really factoring in the actual impact to the people who use the space, whether they're office workers or family members or hospital patients, like thinking about it long term. Like, what does that really mean?
I just want to pause right there with Katie Ryan Balogtas and take a call. Angela in Partyville is here. Angela, hi.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to, for Christmas, my brother gave me some plants that they must have wrapped the dirt and moss and then a wire mesh. And then they hang on a piece of wood on the wall, like you just hook it onto the nails. And then you take it off once a week and water it and then let it dry a little bit and put it back. And it just makes it feel so much like the greenery is in our space much more than a plant in a pot.
Angela, thank you. Katie, what about that approach?
I think that's fantastic. You know, one of the things that we emphasize is that it's not just about plants. However, it can be really effective to have a few plants in your space. It completely transforms it, especially when there is a care factor, when you need to take care of it. You can love it, you can respect it, but it changes the atmosphere and it also changes your attention. Having those plants on the wall, having light stream through them, it changes the experience of the space over the course of the day or even the course of the year. And so you're going to be more aware of it than had it not been, you know, had it just been a potted plant on the ground or, you know, tucked away or outside. So I think it's wonderful that you've, adopted that and that you are caring for it. Caring for plants is a really great way to stay connected with nature. But there's a lot of other benefits associated with caring for plants. It's good for arthritis. It's good for your the non-visual connection. Like the smell of the soil is actually can be quite healthy as well. Being that smell after it rains outside.
Yes.
Yeah. Petrichor.
Yes.
It's actually really rejuvenating. So, you know, walking outside in nature after it rains or watering your plants and keeping that moisture, like it there's
helps.
Something to do. Yeah.
Katie Ryan Balogtas with us as we talk about biophilic design, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore biophilic design that seeks to boost our connection to nature and natural elements like daylight and plants, water and exposed wood, as we spend so much of our time indoors. Bring your questions and comments about arranging living spaces to be more attuned to nature, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie Ryan-Balogtas is an environmental design consultant who specializes in biophilic design. Katie, we might assume that biophilic design is just plain old expensive, that prioritizing well-being in a design will just cost more. How affordable is it to incorporate biophilic designs into a home?
It's an understandable misconception because it's fairly new to our, you know, terminology and our the way we approach design projects. But the reality is that in most cases, for most types of biophilic design or most interventions, you're making those decisions anyway. It's whether you're using biophilic design to direct or filter your design choices. You know, when we talk about biophilic design at the design table, it's usually in three categories. There's nature in the space, which really talks about the physical and experiential or ephemeral qualities of space, like water and plants and airflow and light. Whereas there's also natural analogs. So then you get into the materials and the shapes and patterns. And then the third area is the nature of the space, which we've spoken of just quite a bit today already, is the spatial qualities, so that prospect and refuge and views and things like that. So those spatial ones are going to be really critical to incorporate in the beginning of your design, because those, you know, when you're talking about heights of ceilings or, you know, those views out the window or through a space, those can have large architectural implications. But some of the other ones can actually come along at any time in the design or even be introduced after you're already using the space. And so when you're selecting a material or when you're selecting a wall covering or curtains or upholstery or furniture, it often is something you were already going to do. You're already going to have a couch or throw pillows. You're already going to have a wall or a window treatment, whether it's curtains or blinds. So why not make that choice something that is biophilic? So in that sense, it can have almost no impact and potentially even save, depending on what your options are, money. So in that sense, there is no cost implication.
Were there more biophilic interventions in the pandemic? I mean, was there a resurgence that you saw in biophilic design in the pandemic?
Yes. There's certainly a heightened interest. Mental health became much less taboo to talk about. I mean, it had been leading up to the pandemic, but even more so in the pandemic. And so this recognition, both to be have spaces that you are comfortable in and that you can stay in for during lockdown, but also that ability to get outside and to go into a park, those two, like what's going on in your home and then where, like how accessible those parks are. And at one point they closed the parks in many places, but then there was a fight with some doctors and researchers and professionals recognizing but how important it was for people to get outside, not just because you didn't have the quality. If you have poor air circulation in a space, you know, COVID could actually circulate better, but also just being outside, you're connected to the time of day, the air quality, the plants. And so in both sense, people became aware, like, if I can't be outside all the time, how do I bring nature into my space? And so there was also this investment in space rather than travel. So people were renovating their homes or their backyards. And so biophilia really surged in interest.
I bet it was like maybe an aha moment. Like, I wonder, how did you respond as a designer in a design firm?
Well, initially, initially I was skeptical because I really didn't believe that people would, they would adopt it while it was necessary and then be like, okay, well, the pandemic's over. This, that isn't important anymore. I was curious to see how long it would persist, this interest or renewed interest in this connection with nature. And I don't know what's happening at the home, like the residential level. I don't tend to work on the single family homes. But certainly within the workplace, as a way to both create healthy workplaces, but also encourage people to come back to the office. Like, how do we make our offices more appealing as a destination? Because some companies are just desperate to get people back in the office, even if it's not back in the office every day. So they're rethinking how the office is designed, but they're also supporting work from home. So I know of some companies that are encouraging people at home to think about whether how their desk is oriented, you know, what they see, like, can they see out the window? Do they have breaks in the middle of the day for them to go enjoy nature? So there's much more transparency and flexibility in our choices to support the mental health and to support other aspects of our health and well-being, not just the mental. But, you know, because companies want you to perform, whether they measure productivity or if it's just general performance and your workplace or remote workplace satisfaction and your loyalty to the company, they want to retain you. So how do we support our remote workers in the best way we can? And one of those is to, you know, provide or guidance, if not even a budget, for ensuring that your at-home workplace is more biophilic.
Katie Ryan-Balaktis with us as we talk about how spaces evoke emotion and biophilic design. She's an environmental design consultant in New York. You can join in with your questions and your comments about biophilic design in your own spaces, in your workplaces, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie, here we are in Wisconsin with more than 14 million acres of farmland in our state as of 2021. Do corn or wheat fields, crop fields have biophilic aspects?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a huge culture around that type of agriculture. And so that it's a connection to place. Like, so I don't think, you know, if you were to Google or like just go online and look for biophilic design, the examples you get would be, you'd likely get a lot of vegetation and be tropical.
Be tropical, lush.
Yes. And you're like, sure, that's really biophilic. But if the intent is to connect people to place for stewardship, for just love of place and, you know, and other benefits, recognizing your local culture and climate and ecosystems is going to be equally important, if not more important. And seasonality is part of that. So there's seasons when things are cut down or trimmed or harvested, and other times when they're not, when they're covered with snow or when they're covered in wildflowers that then die, you know, a month or week or day later. You know, that is just part of, that's a connection to natural systems. And that is really important for stewardship.
You mentioned materials and patterns. Can you go into that a little bit more, how they influence or involve biophilic design?
Yeah, absolutely. And that actually circles back to this, the idea of cornfields or what other industry might be common in that region. It's that materials that evoke local place, like wood that's sourced locally, and ideally manufactured locally, when you start getting into sustainability or your carbon footprint, things like that, you know, that local is good. But this is how biophilia ties into sustainability as well, or green building. So when you're choosing materials for a design, whether it's for interior design or architecture or your terrace or patio, thinking about something that is locally sourced can really help both connect you to place, but also give you some sort of restorative experience. The one thing that is really fantastic about wood is that the grain within wood, that you can see the grain, those lines that kind of, they're not totally straight, but they're all more or less parallel, whether they're waving or straight. Those are fractal in characteristic. And we, from the research, we understand that fractal patterns and just the collinear patterns are really easy for us to process because we've for millennia been experiencing them in nature. So when we see them in products like wood, we know exactly what it is. It brings a sense of comfort. Our prefrontal cortex in our brain calms down and we're able to relax mentally, restore. And so it reduces fatigue. And that's not a process that we're conscious of. It just happens naturally. And so choosing wood with a really nice pattern grain or a live edge, you know, raw edge wood on it for a tabletop. And, you know, that can be considered trendy, but in fact, there's actually a real health benefit to it as well.
I'm going to just pause right there. Environmental design consultant Katie Ryan Balogtas with us, our guide to the intersection of nature and architecture. Still time to bring up your questions about biophilic design, 800-642-1234 to join in. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What if our homes could evoke the same feeling as being outdoors? The environmental design is called biophilic. Join in with how you bring the natural world into your living space, how it makes you feel. 800-642-1234. Katie Ryan Balogtas is an environmental design consultant specializing in biophilic design and stays with us. Let's bring on Courtney in Barneveld. Courtney, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
So we built our house with whole trees timber, and if you don't mill a log, then the grain's actually stronger, and it's also nice because you have whole trees in your living space. It's nice to look at. But the building code, the state building code, doesn't allow for whole trees to be used in framing unless you have a special approval from an architect or an engineer. So I'm wondering if Katie can comment on the use of whole trees. It's, you know, obviously more environmentally friendly to just cut down a tree and use it in your building. And in the same way, also like cob and straw clay, those kind of things. It's just hard to get through the code. Thank you.
Courtney, thank you. Katie, what about building code here?
That is tricky, particularly because it's different everywhere. So it's harder to just say, well, it was done in California or is done in, you know, South Dakota, so why can't we do it here? I do agree with you that the whole, like, less processed, it's more cost effective, it's more biophilic, and it creates a great connection and ownership over your design. And so I fully encourage it. But building code can be a non-starter. So my first recommendation, if you haven't done it already, is to find out if there are other buildings in your district or region that have done it before. If you can find other examples of it being passed or permission granted, you might be able to skirt that, that getting a sign off from an architect or an engineer.
Courtney, what workarounds did you use in your design?
So I actually just Googled Whole Trees because I knew there was a company in Madison called Whole Trees Design, and they led me to the architect who started Whole Trees. His name is Roald Gunderson, and he actually pro bono helped us design our house, and he was the person that basically looked at the diameter of the trees and how many trees or logs we needed per, you know, for the floor joists or the rafters or whatever. And so he would approve that. So you basically, you just need somebody that knows like what diameter and how many logs to use or how many trees to use. And so then he just like basically approved the design for through the inspector. The inspector just needed his like engineer number, architect number.
Wow. Courtney, thank you for that insight. Needing someone with that expertise in your corner, Katie.
Yeah, it's it is tricky, and it's great that you had that resource. I mean, I've worked on projects where you have extremely well-funded and well-known organizations that want to build a wooden structure, and the local departments won't allow it, and then so they have to go find, you know, examples of where it's been done before, and then convince them that the height and the materials are, you know, not going to be, you know, fire retardant, all these other challenges that we're just not, I think we're in a culture of having to prove, prove that it's been done before, even when it hasn't been done before. And so, it's kind of an ongoing battle. So what I would say is if you had a good experience and it worked well, write about it, tell people, let people know that there are ways that, you know, to share that knowledge, because we want to encourage people to adopt similar practices, both for environmental reasons, but also for love of place and for your, you know, home experience.
In general, are building codes keeping up with biophilic design?
I wouldn't say they have. They're still, many are still trying to understand how to adopt green development or sustainable development in a way that everyone can generally agree on. Mm-hmm. So you know how in some place, some cities or states, it may or may not be required or it may be disallowed to follow a green building rating system. So that's still a struggle in many places. In our national capital, it's actually any new building is required to be, I think, LEED Gold, if I'm not mistaken. So there is progress. There's many other cities that may have that kind of requirement. Maybe it's focused on resilience. Maybe it's focused specifically on energy performance. But with respect to biophilic design, it's actually worked its way into the green building rating standards like LEED or WELL Building. So I think it's more suited to having to being integrated into other existing systems. Otherwise, it becomes a checklist. Hmm. And biophilia and health and well-being is not about a checklist. It's not always quantifiable. It's very qualitative. And so we want to avoid this checklist mentality. Because otherwise, it's not being designed for the purpose. It's just saying, are there plants? Yes, check. Okay, we got that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're offering a biophilic experience. Just because it has something doesn't make it so. So we have to ask ourselves, why are we doing this? What is the experience of it? And I would say a really good example is when you see an advertisement for a company that has a beautiful green wall in the lobby of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a PR piece. It's mm-hmm. how they're marketing. It has nothing truly to do with the health and well-being of the people in it, because you need to be able to experience the green, like to view it from, say, your desk. But if the only time you view it is when you're leaving the building or you're before you get in the elevator, that's not really giving you the opportunity to connect with it.
I want to just touch down here in a moment. The International Biophilic Summit taking place online, including experts from around the world. You're a jurist on this summit. How expansive is the biophilic movement around the world?
It's actually quite expansive, and this summit is a new initiative. So there's other ones that have been around globally for several years, and so the Biophilic Cities Network is probably the most international, and it really works with governments to identify opportunities within their city to improve the biophilic conditions or quality of that city. And so each city might have different focus, and that's fine. So, but they all come together on this platform, Biophilic Cities Network. But then there's also the International Living Future Institute, and that's focused more on the individual buildings. They do some community work, but it's primarily on the buildings and the interiors. And then you have platforms like this summit in Europe. It's based out of Italy, but it's all Europe. And then also, you know, has reaches into other parts of the world, but they are looking more broadly, not just architecture, but also photography, fashion, artificial intelligence, and product design, you know, anything you can think of, really. It's just trying to, there are people who are already doing this, and many people design biophilic, they use biophilic design instinctively, and they don't even call it that.
Wow.
Right. So this is really, biophilic design is really just, it's a language for having a conversation.
And it's all around us. Katie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Katie Ryan-Balogtas, an environmental design consultant specializing in biophilic design, director of projects at Terrapin Bright Green. That's a New York environmental design firm. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.